stars live here.
Are you ready?
On air. Online.
Are you ready to have a good time?
On your smart speaker and wherever you stream. Broadcasting from Montreal and around the world.
The Jeremy White Show, available wherever you stream.
Catch up on past interviews and episodes on demand now.
Subscribe so you don't miss any of it.
Guest is a member of one of the most legendary rock and roll bands of all time. The latest record, Ghost Stories, coming out on April 12th. Pre-order it now wherever you get your music, and the new single, So Supernatural, and the music video, fantastic. Gotta go check that out on YouTube. Welcome to the show for the first time, the one, the only, from Blue Oyster Cult, Mr. Eric Bloom. How's it going, man?
How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. It's Larry. I literally just got off Zoom with, you're gonna laugh at this, I interviewed Martha Wash from the Weather Girls.
Oh, that's different.
Very different. And she also sang a bunch of those big 90s like dance club classic hits. And we were talking about some obscure, like weird bills that she got paired on, like back in the day. She was like on a weird bill with like Flock of Seagulls and like a bunch of different things. But it made me think, like, back in the day, Blue Oyster Cult, I mean, like, you guys were like on all kinds of crazy bills. Like, you see show posters all the time popping. I mean, like Blue Oyster Cult and Van Halen and Blue Oyster Cult and Kiss. And today you just don't see those amazing bills anymore, you know?
Well, they used to be, you know, the late Bill Graham was the best at pairing eclectic shows. Although our first tour was probably the most unusual. Mm. When we were first starting, even before the first album came out, our manager, Sandy, was colluding with Columbia Records, and he put together a tour, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, Blue Oyster Cult, and the Birds.
Oh, Jesus.
Now, think about that a second. Now, and we were in the middle, believe it or not, we were so hyped as being an up-and-comer that we were in the middle. And so we had to follow the Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Jesus.
And we got slammed.
Yeah.
Because we really were not very good. Mm. And so we had to go on after John McLaughlin, and it was just ridiculous. we should have just stayed in the dressing room. And and then the Birds were amazing.
But it's kind of funny to hear, like,
that was 1971, I would say.
But fans, I mean, like, they were really segregated. I mean, like, you never knew. I guess you were playing to people that weren't fans of yours, so you kind of had to try and win them over. But if you didn't, like, I mean, they were throwing shit at you, right?
Well, it wasn't physical.
Yeah.
It was just, get off, please.
Yeah, I mean, like, Sammy Hagar tells stories about that, like, with, like, Montrose and stuff. And, like, they would be throwing shit. He opened up for Kiss, and they were throwing shit at him, and, like, crazy stuff like back in the day. That doesn't happen anymore.
We did a very unfortunate show. Nobody was mad at us, but we had the Raspberries open for us.
Ooh.
And I love that band. And Eric Carmen is a great guy and a very talented guy. And it was in Chicago, and the Raspberries opened for us in a venue that had a curtain. And they curtain opened, and as soon as it opened, people threw shit at them. It was a very rude audience.
Oh, jeez.
Because, Please Baby Go All the Way was their big hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they were a really great band, and our audience was not very kind to them.
Yeah. I always like the Raspberries because, like, they sound British, but they're not.
No, they were a Midwest band, I believe.
Yeah.
And I just thought they were a great band, but nobody wanted to hear what they had to say.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy how, like, you think about that, and it's like a buddy, my buddy Adam is a huge fan of you guys, and I am as well. But we were talking, and he wanted me to ask you: is there any chance that maybe we'll see a legitimate 4K upgrade Blu-ray kind of thing of the infamous concert Black Sabbath and Blue Oyster Cult from 1980?
From what I understand, is that's all on Tony Iommi.
Oh yeah,
yeah, he's like putting the kibosh on it.
No way. I wonder why.
That's what I was told. No, I don't know if that's facts.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that show, I mean, like, within the fandom, everybody talks about it. I mean, like, everybody's got that bootleg somewhere. And it's like, you know, it's become infamous at this point.
I believe there's bootlegs around. Yeah. But I have no say in it.
Hmm. But even if you guys were on the bill, I mean, like, your recordings, like, you couldn't, like, do anything about it?
Ask my management. You know, this is, you know, I'm the last guy to have anything to say about it. But according to what I was told, and my management has a piece of the action on that, so they would make money.
Well, yeah, of course.
Tony Iommi doesn't want to see the light of day.
Hmm. What a weirdo. Why wouldn't you want that out there? It's classic.
I don't know.
Talk a little bit about Ghost Stories, of course, coming out April 12th. You can pre-order now wherever you get your music. Frontiers Music, fantastic label. So all of these songs are essentially songs that have never seen the light of day. Took them and reimagined them and finally getting them out there. I mean, what was that process like? I mean, like, how did you decide what to choose and not to choose?
Well, again, I'm a little two giant steps away from that. Mm. These songs, well, let's go back in history for your listeners or viewers or both.
Yeah.
Around 1978, we were making, you know, records almost every year or year and a half. And as we're working on new material, some songs just didn't make it. You know, they'd be the 11th song on a 10 song record or the 12th song on a 10th song record, whatever. And not every song makes every record. They get worked on, they get halfway done, they get three quarters of the way done, other songs seem stronger or whatever. And, or just we get mired in, you know, this song needs a better bridge, or the key in the song isn't right for the vocal, or whatever reason it is.
Right.
Songs just don't make it. So luckily for us, our sound man at the time, who also was our front of house mixer, George Geranius, who went to Stony Brook University with Sandy Perlman and Richard Meltzer, who wrote, Sandy wrote a lot of our lyrics, and Richard Meltzer wrote Burning For You, the lyric. George went to Stony Brook with them and was our sound man for our first decade or so. We rehearsed in his loft in Brooklyn, which is right near the Brooklyn Bridge. And he ran tape of all those rehearsals at that time, including the songwriting parts. So he ran a reel-to-reel stereo recorder.
Oh, wow.
And he dredged up these tapes. So when Frontiers Records said we could use a new product from you guys, our manager got a hold of George. Do we have these tapes? And George says, yes, there is material there. So Steve, our manager, listened to the tapes with George. George sent the tapes. He baked the tapes. Now, you are in the audio universe. You know what that means.
Yeah.
Maybe your listeners do not. I will explain that briefly.
Yeah.
Audio tape and or videotape is made of a material that oxidizes. So especially over time, if you leave it in storage, the tape oxidizes and degrades. Mm-hmm. So the main method of getting that oxidation off the tape so the tape doesn't degrade is you literally have to bake it, sometimes in an oven, literally the oven in your house, or sometimes any kind of heat method. Some people make a cardboard box and they put a hair dryer in there, or a couple of hair dryers.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like a Rube Goldberg method of making your own oven. And you put a temperature gauge inside to, you know, you can go on YouTube and learn how to bake tapes.
Yeah.
And
you got to be careful because you leave it in there too long and then it's fucked.
Right. Right. You have to, usually YouTube has a couple of methods of how to bake tapes.
Yeah.
And this is how real studios do that. And the old tapes should be stored properly. But, you know, when you have old tapes and they're yours, you don't really have the proper storage. So no. They're usually in a closet somewhere. So if you have old tapes of your own, these tapes oxidize and degrade. So George baked the tapes and then listened to them, fixed them up as best he could, sent them off to us. And they went to our wunderkind, Richie Castellano, who is a 44-year-old young man who's been in Blue Oyster Cult, you know, a good long time now. And he's very up with the current techniques of recording and has co-produced a lot of our later stuff and has written stuff with me on the last record 3 years ago.
Right.
And he's like my third son. And so Richie and Steve, our manager, got these tapes and listened to them. Some of the stuff which is on this recording is good. And some of the stuff they listened to either lacked vocals or lacked parts and was rejected. And what you're hearing is the stuff that made the grade. Mm-hmm. So now some of the songs needed, like for instance, the first quote unquote single, which is So Supernatural, didn't have a vocal on it or the vocal was degraded. So Joe Bouchard volunteered to come in, or Richie and Steve asked him to come in and sing. And he was amenable to that. So came over to Richie's and re-sang the song for the first time since the late 70s. So on So Supernatural, that's Joe singing today. Mm-hmm. It might have needed, I'm not sure what else it needed. It might have been just the vocal. Some of the other songs on the project needed a guitar part. Maybe there was no rhythm guitar on it because it wasn't done back in the day. So Richie added a guitar part. Different things like that were done.
Yeah.
So little bits and pieces were added to bring it to fruition. But other than that, it's 90% what it was back then.
Yeah. Do you hear the difference between, say, you know, the take
that was... Excuse me 1 second.
Yeah, yeah, go for it.
Something wacky on my phone.
Somebody's texting you up a storm.
Oh, it's a YouTube video I was watching.
Oh.
That's very funny. I was watching an animal video.
Oh, nice.
For some reason, it's replaying itself. It's very funny.
You got it? It's going to start playing again.
I turned my phone off.
Oh, okay. There you go. I was going to say,
I like animal videos.
Animals are awesome. Come on. I was just going to say, do you hear the difference between the, say, like, you know, the original analog takes versus the overdubs that you did digitally?
No, Rich, you made it dovetail perfectly.
Yeah. There's no, because a lot of people talk about that. I mean, like analog versus digital. I mean, like, and this is essentially, I mean, like best of both worlds in a sense, because you got those original takes and then you got to transfer them. And like, was it all mixed digitally too, like in Pro Tools?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
So like on all those tapes that he recorded, is like all the banter like between like the songwriting session like still intact? Like, are you going to leave any of that in there?
No, I don't know. You know, that's a question for George Serranius. He probably has a lot of that.
Yeah.
You know, that was right by the Brooklyn Bridge in Brooklyn. George and his brother had a loft there, and his brother Tony was on our crew at the time. And after he left our employ, he went on to be Geddy Lee's roadie for many years.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that he was kind of like the studio engineer, but it was also your front of house guy. I mean, like, there was nobody that knew how to make the sound, make the band sound as good as you can than that guy.
Oh, some of our best live recordings, George was involved. Absolutely.
Yeah. When you have somebody that just knows how the band is supposed to sound, I mean, that's your like secret weapon, I would think.
He was an integral part of our earliest days. Absolutely. I give him all the kudos I can.
So this record's coming out, Ghost Stories. By the way, why is it's called Ghost Stories, but it's coming out in April. Should it came out for Halloween?
that's beyond me. But you know, this a lot of this has to do with Frontiers and what they wanted.
Yeah.
And we wanted another product. These tapes were available. And here it is.
Well, fans are going to love this stuff because I heard a preview of a lot of the songs and like just classic Blue Oyster Cult. I mean, like these songs could have been fantastic on a record back in the day. And, you know, with the modernized mix.
I think one of the coolest things about it is people get to hear, A, the original band.
Yep.
And B, a lot of showcase with Alan Lanier in it, which is, you know, he's gone. Yeah. So this is most likely the last chance people get to hear Alan play.
Mm-hmm. And is this going to be the last record the band does?
Well, there's a lot of record company speak about you know, this is the finale, but you never know what might happen, you know, because, you know, people like myself or Buck Dharma, you know, who's to say we might not get inspired again to do more?
Yeah. You never know. Maybe those creative juices will get flowing and we'll get, you know, another classic.
Well, I use my favorite example. Kiss has done 10 or 15 or 20 final tours.
Yeah. They just did their last ever.
Well, which they said 10 years ago.
Right. And even before that, in the, you know, late 90s, yeah, before Peter left again. So, hey, it's kind of funny how, you know, back in the day, I mean, like when you Kiss opened for you and then almost like a year to the day later, like you guys were opening for Kiss. That must have been like kind of a funny situation.
Oh, I don't know if it was a year later. It was a few years later. Yeah, their first show ever was opening for us. They were fourth billed. Actually, they weren't billed at all. It was a favor.
Oh.
Yeah, more power to them. You know, they've stood the test of time.
The there was a classic poster I saw. My buddy Adam sent it to me. It was Iggy Pop, Kiss, and Blue Oyster Cult in New York City one night. Do you recall anything about that gig?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That was their first big show. They were added to the bill. They were not billed at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was Teenage Lust, which was my friend Harold Black was the main person in that band. He just passed away. Iggy Pop was in the middle, and Blue Oyster Cult was the headliner.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kiss was not on the bill. They were added as a fourth act to be the opener. And I watched them from the side, you know, the stage, because I was told you got to see these guys kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were great. They were great the first show.
So you didn't know anything about them? You were just like,
no, other than you got to watch these guys. You know,
what did you think when you saw them up there?
I thought they were great. And I took some pictures of them, like a 64 ASA slide, 35 millimeter, you know, pictures of them. And I gave them to Murray Krugman, who was our co-producer back on our first album. And they were stolen out of his office.
Oh, man.
Yep.
Shit, you know, those probably be worth some coin these days.
Yeah. You know, what are you going to do?
What was the backstage scene like at the time? Was it like, you know, you guys were the headliners? Like, did you treat the opening bands like the opening bands? Or was it kind of like camaraderie? Like,
I don't think we ever were hard asses about anything with anybody.
No.
I mean, sometimes we were treated poorly in our opening days. You know, lights and sound were never given to opening acts, you know, the best, like,
what does that mean though? Like they wouldn't let you mic all your drums or like the guitar amps, like,
oh no. I mean, never, you know, sometimes we were sandbagged. AC/DC sandbagged us.
No way. What did they do?
Oh, just, you know, we were not given the full rig, you know, kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah.
Then apparently some slight was done to them, and so they took it out on us at a big show in England. But, you know, shit like that was done.
Was it serious, or was this sort of just hijinks, like, you know, guys getting back at each other? Like, or was it serious
business?
There's
a little bit of all the above, you know. I'm going back to the 70s. You know, I don't think that shit is done anymore. But you know, when you play, you know, a big concert, very often not everything is given to an opening act of what's available.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of normal. Like if there's four follow spots, maybe you're given one, mm-hmm, or maybe none if you're the opening act, you know. It's just kind of normal stuff. As you know, all right, kid, this is what you get when you're just starting.
Yeah, try and win them over with your music, not with the show.
Yeah, but, you know, it might not be that way these days.
Yeah. I saw an interview recently with, I think it was the bass player for the Melvins. He was talking about how, like, they were on tour with, I think it was like a band like White Zombie, and their tour manager was just, like, treating them terribly. Like, you need to wear your laminates. You're like, you can't go this way. You can't talk to the band. No interaction. But he's like, listen, we toured with Kiss. Gene Simmons was the nicest guy. You need anything, come and see me. Geddy Lee, Rush, the same thing. It's like, I guess it really depends on like the level of the bands that you're out there
well,
with.
Well, I won't mention the band, but it's a band that had two girls up front. Okay. Mm-hmm. Draw your own conclusion. And it was a big, big show. And each band had its own Winnebago for a dressing room on a field. And two goons came over to us and said, get back in your dressing room because the band is heading towards the stage. Like we're going to go rush the band and bother them on their way to the stage.
Come on.
Exactly. So sometimes it gets silly like that and other times not.
Now, do you think the artist is even aware of that or is that just their management kind of like,
we don't, I can't, I'm just telling you what happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's been times where that very same band, I always go and say hi to everybody. And if the other band wants to come in and say hi to us, we're fine with that.
Yeah.
And there's been times like that very same band I've walked over to say, because I played with them more than once.
Yeah.
Many times over the years, I walked in to say hello to them. And they looked at me like I was wearing a pair of brown shoes.
Oh, what the? Damn.
Yeah. So,
I mean, everybody has good days and bad days, but come on.
Yeah. So, and you know, when we played Black and Blue, you know, the Brits in that band, you know, were not overly friendly.
Right. Yeah.
So what can I tell you?
Here's a random question for you. Don't Fear the Reaper, obviously used in a lot of films, but the original, Halloween, and then like 16 years later, The Stand, which do you prefer?
As far as the use of the song?
Yeah.
Oh, Halloween.
Halloween.
Oh, yeah. That's, and there's an anecdote about that.
Oh.
Yeah. We did not know it was being used in that movie.
Really?
We were not told.
So you just,
can you imagine?
Wow. So they used the song without your permission. And then
now the record label licensed the song without telling us. So a friend of ours said, do you know that your song is in that movie Halloween? We go, no.
Wow.
So there was a little renegotiation after that.
I would think so. I mean, like, Carmen, really? Yeah. No way. So it wasn't in your contract that they had to ask you, like, what they can put the song in?
I don't know about the legal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I only know that we were not told that the song was in the movie.
Yeah.
Until after the movie came out.
Damn.
Yeah.
So then after that, I can imagine that sales of the single or the record would have probably done a little bit of more business.
I'm sure it was helpful. But it's a classic scene when they're in the car and it's on the radio.
Yeah.
You know, Jamie Lee Curtis in the car with a girlfriend. And Don't Fear the Reaper comes on the radio. They're pulling up to the house. Great.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of good uses of that song in film.
No, absolutely. It
certainly makes a good feeling, you know?
Yeah. No, cool. It's just got that sound. I mean, like... It's funny how that song has just sort of had like such weird history over there, from film to even like the SNL bit and everything. It's like, it's kind of got like its own lore of its own.
It does. You know, Burning for You was in Joe Dirt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was kind of cool.
Oh, man, that's a great scene too.
And then Veteran of the Psychic Wars was in the Heavy Metal movie.
Yep.
That was kind of good. There's been, you know, a lot of BOC tunes used in a few different things.
Over the years, you've played, obviously, you're famous for the SG, but I've seen photos of you playing that really cool red Strat with a Floyd Rose on it and a humbucker. What made you switch over from playing, like, you know, just like those classic SGs to more of like a Super Strat kind of guitar? Was there a difference?
Oh, I, you know, over the years, I'd say in general, I've acquired other guitars here and there, but I always come back to a black SG.
Yeah. Yeah, because that, like, I mean, like those Strats in the 80s, I mean, they kind of took over, right? Once Eddie Van Halen sort of did the whole thing with the Frankenstein, all of a sudden everybody needed a Strat body with the humbucker and the whammy bar. It had its own sound and everything.
Well, people got on Clapton's case when he changed over to a Strat from an SG.
Right.
But
But now everybody forgets that he played in Eshy and he's just the Strad guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. To me, you know, here's a quick anecdote. Richie's father owns a music store.
Oh.
Let's plug that. Castellano's House of Music in Staten Island, New York. And it's a mom and pop music store. It's not a gigantic place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great little music store. And they teach, you know, kids how to play music, or anybody.
Right.
And they have, you know, a nice selection of guitars and stuff. And one day Richie calls me. This has got to be 8 or 9 years ago. Richie says, you know, my father got in an SG in trade, you know, and he said, it's kind of, use the vernacular, screwed up. and it has kind of some holes in it where some switches were pulled out and the pickups are not really very good. He said, but it's a 68. Oh. And I said, but I'm interested. He said, it doesn't have a good finish on it. It's screwed up. And he mentioned the price. I said, well, for that price, I'll take it.
Yeah.
So I took it to the guy who fixes my guitars up, who's in a music store in New Jersey, which is no longer in existence. Pastore Music in New Jersey, they're gone.
Mm.
But the luthier there is this great older Italian guy, Ronaldo. Ronaldo built my logo-shaped guitar, which I still have.
Oh, yeah.
Took it to Ronaldo and speaks with a heavy Italian accent, which I won't try to imitate. And he says, Eric, I said, you know, I want it black. I want the logo, you know, in mother of pearl, like the old ones. And he gave it back to me. And it was fine, but it needed to be set up. And the 68 SGs just have a great neck. They're thin. And I have small hands, so it's perfect. So Richie's cousin, who lives right in Richie's neighborhood, very good at setting guitars up. So he set it up for me perfectly. And that's the one I've been playing live for about the last 6 or 7 years. And it's just mint. It's great. It doesn't look anything like when I first got it. All the holes were filled in. The finish is redone.
Yeah.
The bar on it is great. So any pictures of me with that guitar, that's the one I've been playing live for about the last 7 or 8 years.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it was just a piece of junk when I first got it.
Yeah.
And it's just great.
It's hilarious. You never know when like a gift like that's going to come into your life. And then boom, it's your favorite guitar. Like.
Yeah, and exactly. And it was, you'd never know from the way I first got it.
Yeah. I have this like shitty Squire Tele that I picked up at the music store for like $150. And like, I'm always tracking, like playing. I grabbed that before like my Eddie Van Halen Wolfgang, like before the, like, it's crazy how you just gravitate towards a guitar sometimes.
Well, like Richie, who's like a fabulous guitar player, he just keeps trading up.
Yeah.
You know, he keeps getting something new and better.
Yeah, well, that's it. When you're constantly,
and he cannot let go. He cannot let go. He keeps getting better and better and better and better. Different. He won't sell anything.
Yeah. Have you kept all your guitars over the years? Have you gotten rid of some?
You know, some of them. The Hard Rock has a whole bunch of mine.
Right.
They have, you know, half a dozen of my older ones.
The real deal ones, or those like the so called, you know.
No, a couple of them.
Yeah,
but I've sold a few over the years. Some collectors have hit me up and I sold a few.
Yeah.
I moved recently, a couple of years ago, and I had to get rid of a few because I had no place to put them. So I have denuded myself of a few, but I still have some.
Do you have that regret, that remorse? You're like, oh, why did I get rid of those?
I was talking to Rick Nielsen. He's got a zillion guitars.
Yeah.
And you know, I think he must have like commercial space to keep them. I just don't.
No, he's definitely got like a storage facility for all that stuff. Yeah. It's like he's got his, yeah, like a million.
Yeah. But I never really took the time and space to keep stuff. I think Buck has a bunch.
Yeah. What about live amp wise? I mean, are you still using some classic vintage gear, or have you gone to the digital route?
No. You know, I just have a small tube amp at home, and we had, you remember that, you know, where do you live?
I'm in Montreal.
Okay. Well, if you remember, we had that big Hurricane Sandy.
Yes.
Which was, I don't know, 10 years ago?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, a lot of people lost a lot of good shit.
Yeah, well, we had a storage facility in New Jersey, and we lost all, our entire back lawn. Our storage place was in New Jersey, and it went underwater.
Oh, man.
So anything we had, you know, that was totally ruined. So any older stuff we had was just, our crew guys had to go in there, and everything turned to mush.
Like all like the vintage amps, like all the gear from all the back in the day, like.
Yep. All that stuff.
Oh man.
And they had to go in there and just pull it all out and throw it away. It was just a mess.
Nothing was salvageable. It was just drowned.
Yeah. Totally underwater.
Oh man.
Our stuff was all on the first floor of a storage building.
Hmm. Yeah. The lesson there, make sure it's at least on the third floor.
Yeah. I'll say.
Oh Jesus. Well, look. Geez, new record coming out. This is super exciting. Make sure you go and pre-order it. Ghost Stories, available April 12th. New stuff from Blue Oyster Cult featuring old new stuff, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's from 78 to 83. It's a variety of different kinds of material from back then. Not just outtakes. It's just stuff that was worked on and never quite finished.
Mm-hmm.
And includes some newer vocals, some newer guitar parts. And what's really neat is it's the original band and with some touch-ups. And especially for hardcore BOC fans, it's quite nostalgic.
Yeah. No, it's going to be really good. And the album cover is awesome. The music video for So Supernatural is just really cool stuff too. I mean, like it's a really good package for fans. I'm highly recommending everybody to go and pick this up. So,
yeah, and it brings back a certain era of when we were sort of riding high.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, Eric, it was fantastic to chat with you. We'll have to do this again and tell some more tales.
Yeah, I love your area. I love Montreal.
The Jeremy White Show.
Get exclusive interviews and bonus content on demand now. Visit youtube.com/Jeremy White Show.